Chapter 14. Radical Memories. You like to think memory goes far back, though remembering was never recommended. Forget all that, the world says. The world's had a lot of practice. No one should adhere to the facts that contribute to narrative, the facts that create lives. Claudia Rankine, Citizen and American Lyric. In some important sense, DeMario's quest for justice has gone unfulfilled. Since the Ron Graham case, he's taken the Creek Nation to court, both in their courts and in the U.S. District Court system. And each time he's entered those courts, he's left without a win. In the case of the District Court, unlike the Cherokee Nation, which lost to its former black citizens in 2017, he only earned a dismissal. His argument is clear. You being the Creek Nation, have to follow the law. He and his clients are trying to claw back their claim to ancestry and identity using the law. They refuse to forget, no matter how easy it is to do so, no matter how simple life could be if they accepted their blackness without its former residence in the nation that once accepted them. They are fighting for an identity, a complete identity. And they're asking all of us to do what often seems too radical for America. Remember. Remembrance is pain. Even remembering the good can induce pain. Remembering the good times when the good times have turned bad triggers the wincing we'd rather avoid. In America, we often choose to forget in order to avoid the pain. We assemble our individual and collective past based on where we want the status quo to stay now and in the future. As a society, we, inconveniently for those on the margins, construct our present and future on a history that absolves us from the pain. Perhaps that's why we don't like to remember. Maybe that's why DeMario is the aggravating nag to the Creek Nation, because even though circumstances for the Creek could always be better, considering that they too live on the margins of society, his existence, his constant reminders of who his family has been, indict everything about the exclusive life the Creeks lead, and in turn, the context within which our society has allowed this exclusion to take place. It reminds the Creek leadership that its present and future will remain incomplete without accepting the stories of DeMario and his ancestors. These incomplete present and future identities, however, are not limited to the case of DeMario and his family, his clients and their families. There was the project of turning the Creek Nation into a race that could set aside citizens like Johnny May from other citizens. Thanks to the efforts of Dawes, this project created a litmus test that limited the extent to which one could construct its history upon the pain they had endured. And when Clark Cox, the chief of the Creek Nation, exclaimed that the Negro would soon outnumber the Indian and led the march to a new constitution that did not include the very Negro who counted the Creek Nation home, it too introduced a stumbling block for countless others to memorialize the lives of their families who had done so much to make the Creek Nation home. Claude Cox did the same thing that Henry Dawes had done. He declared who would and who would not be Creek without first considering the full measure of history that produced the moment in which he lived, though arguably Cox had more claim to do so than the white man from Massachusetts who wanted to help. Chief Cox, however, did something far more dangerous. He discriminated against the black citizens of his nation and cloaked it as protection for an identity. But the identity Cox sought to protect had holes in its construction. It was ahistorical, dismissive even. By discounting the claim that Cowtom's descendants have in the Creek Nation, Cox tried to invalidate their claim on history. And by invalidating their claim, he can claim the ultimate prize of white supremacy, getting those on the margins to adopt the very segregatory habits and practices they once bucked against. We have seen this trajectory elsewhere, and it also reminds us that this constant upward trajectory that life improves for those who wait long enough is wrong. But what do we become when we do not remember? Who are we if we avoid the past out of a fear of the pain? Cowtom and his descendants, as well as everyone who's taken up his cause over the years, have asked a fundamental question. How can we be truly moral people if we ignore who we are and where we came from? The answer, in short, is that we can't. Cow Tom, for Ethan Allen Hitchcock, was Yargi's Negro, his Negro Tom. He was Black and Creek and was to Hitchcock undignified, nothing more than a Negro who belonged to another man. He and all of us can be and are, in fact, many things at once. Or in other words, we contain multitudes. Some call this intersectionality the collision of identities, but others have put it more simply. I am a narrative, someone's almost forgotten story, remembered. You and I, DeMario and Johnny May, we are all narratives, aspects of which have been forgotten, often on purpose. But we don't fully become who it is that we want to be without first remembering who we have been. You might be reading this fully initiated into the varied histories that brought you to this moment. You might, unlike me when I started writing this book, have the fullest and most comprehensive understanding of what it means to be you, because you understand where you came from and who you are. But in America, unless you're a white, binary, cisgender man, in other words, a straight white guy with some money or land whose identity and rights have never been on a referendum or on a court docket, your existence is protest, and your decision to remember is radical. James Baldwin once remarked that to be African American is to be African without any memory, and American without any privilege. While this is an apt description of what it means to be Black in America, it could also describe what it means to be Black Creek. To be both Black and Creek is to be in a constant state of trying to persuade your country's history to give a damn about you. Because the history of those who tell it hasn't cared much about what it means to be Black or Creek. DeMario Solomon Simmons, Johnny May Austin, and countless others have been striving to be remembered and included for who they are by telling us who their ancestors were. Contrary to Baldwin's observation, these Black Creeks had privilege once, but not necessarily in what we'd consider America. They got it by their heritage, but that heritage is fading. So they have made their lives about Sankofa. Go back and get it. That is the charge implicit in the term Sankofa. From the Twi language of Ghana, the term means the rescuing of what is being left behind. That is the idea the Black Creeks want to maintain. They know that there is a risk of Black Creek history being left behind, and subsequently, their identity. They know that if they don't start their freedmen bands, host conferences, continue their archival work, file for their own tribal recognition, and file suits for re-inclusion in the Creek Nation, their stories might be doomed to fade. At the heart of Sankofa is the idea that memory of the past is the key to liberation in the future. We are not as simple as white supremacy tells us we are. We can learn that it is in celebrating our complexities that we begin to live abundantly. Remembering the various histories that brought us here is the first step to living empowered lives. DeMario's identity, for example, isn't simple. Nothing about being both Black and Creek is, but his stories and those of his family make clear what is so abstract. Their claim to the American dream came through the Creek Nation, a nation they helped build. They've lost their citizenship, and their loss has changed their destiny. Their ancestors created the future that they wanted in a nation that once enslaved Blacks. DeMario is on a mission to reclaim that future. Remembering's radical characteristics are best understood when we realize that we need our present and future to rectify the ugliness of our past. Often we remember to reconcile instead of remembering to repair. In my hometown of Tulsa, the massacre of Black Wall Street has been remembered. City officials have issued half-hearted apologies about what happened many years ago, reflecting that elements of what happened were harmful. They've built ornate memorials, a history center, and even a park called Reconciliation Park. But they have not fixed much of anything. What's wrong isn't just that Cow Tom's descendants aren't citizens of the Creek Nation. What's wrong is that our history books never told us about this. What's wrong is that we've lived our lives untethered to the history that could propel us toward justice. By virtue of knowing this story, you become a steward in this effort to go back and get it. You now share in the responsibility of trying to appreciate fully the identities of people. You now have what it takes to understand that society's collective identity can bear the pain of remembering what portions of it have been left behind by white supremacy. You can now identify that those on the margins need allies who don't rush to reconciliation without accommodating for and rectifying the weightiness of the truth, which demands reconciliation, restitution, and reparation for those who have been aggrieved. Claudia Rankine said it best. In America, remembering was never recommended. We, on the margins, were supposed to take the lumps society gave us. And after taking our lumps, we were supposed to pretend that the lumps were never there. Forget all of that, the world says, Rankine reminds us. She tells us that the world's had a lot of practice. It's why we expect black folks and brown folks to forget that redlining, mass incarceration, slavery, and inequitably funded education, to name a few, have barred black and brown folks from opportunities that we deserve. Perhaps we all bear the responsibility of expanding our moral imaginations by reconstructing our society's collective identity as one that embraces beautiful, complex histories and cherishes the opportunity to tell those who have not mattered for so long that they do matter. We need to go back and get it so that we might become who we ought to be. Chapter 15, Reparations and the Black Creek. But black history does not flatter American democracy. It chastens it. Ta-Nehisi Coates. In 2003, I was sitting in my small Christian, mostly white school in Tulsa. I was one of two black people to graduate in my class when I first heard of reparations. The school, St. Augustine Academy, 131 students in total from kindergarten through 12th grade, stood on Creek land, less than 4 miles from the cemetery where Legis Perryman and other Black Creek leaders are buried. Despite the proximity, my teachers, from elementary through high school, all but one of whom were white, prided themselves on telling the untold portions of history, often the parts they claimed the elite, anti-Christian, liberal educational and media systems wouldn't tell. That America was somehow a Christian nation. That usually meant telling stories about the untold history of leaders of Western thought. My high school history teacher, a white Calvinist whose credentials were in church history, mocked these reparations as ludicrous excess, as a step too far. And as a 13-year-old black kid, I somehow agreed. Reparations, I was taught, couldn't possibly be for me or my kind. I was lulled into thinking that reparations weren't necessary. Affirmative action was seen as the closest thing to reparations, and even that, prioritizing outreach and admission for people of color and women and getting jobs and into schools, was beyond reasonable consideration. But come Black History Month, we were allowed to remember a few legislative bills with the title Civil Rights or Voting Rights or Fair Housing, actions of the Black people my white teachers liked, and a holiday named after Dr. King, which for years I didn't get off because my school didn't consider it a legitimate holiday. What we were encouraged to forget was everything else. The centuries of violence and inequality against Black people, the centuries of white supremacy, and the centuries of struggles of people like the Black Creek, who didn't fit neatly into the American myth. From where I sat, at age 13, in an Oklahoma classroom, the rise of Black opportunity in America need not be cheapened through tangible benefits. Instead, the lofty language about equity and equality was enough. And perhaps even more precisely, targeting efforts to remember and repair the historical damages visited upon any particular race or ethnic group seemed patently unfair. Regrettably, many people still think like I did at 13 years old. But don't feel bad. Plenty of self-proclaimed political leaders don't think much differently from how I did back then. In 2019, the U.S. House of Representatives took up a bill to investigate reparations, House Resolution 40. When asked what he thought of the bill, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, said, "I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, is a good idea." Arguing that the country should not even study reparations, McConnell added, "We've tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We elected an African-American president." This assessment of our past doesn't just miss the mark. It willfully obscures how deliberately a white supremacist government has systematically undermined and destroyed generations of Black lives. Our culture has become captivated by the question of whether reparations are a worthy goal. Yet as we debate this question, we do so grounded in seemingly elusive, abstract concepts, the original sin of slavery, for example, while avoiding the countless examples of Black suffering rooted in concrete experiences. And those concrete experiences lie around us. But in the case of the Black Creeks, their experiences lie beyond the extent of our moral imagination, stifled by an intentionally limited understanding of history. On the day of the House Resolution 40 hearing, Ta-Nehisi Coates testified before the committee saying, "Many of us would love to be taxed for the things we are solely and individually responsible for, but we are American citizens and thus bound to a collective enterprise that extends beyond our individual and personal reach. The challenge for all those who seek to bring our past to life is how to connect today's readers with a seemingly distant collective enterprise." Perhaps the story of the Black Creeks is that tool. Hearing the stories of Johnny May no longer getting mail from the Creek Nation, of Ron Graham trying so hard to preserve his ancestors' history, of the relief the Cherokee freedmen and their descendants like Kenneth Cooper and Marilyn Van felt when they gained citizenship in the nation their ancestors had helped to build. These stories show the real-world consequences of the United States' willingness to let history fade from forming our identities. These stories represent an unadulterated retelling of our history, no matter how ugly. Exploring this story has been an open invitation to rescue a critical issue from being overlooked. The stories of Cow Tom and his descendants provide the historical and contemporary blueprints to understand reparations. Carla Pratt, a legal scholar and dean of Washburn University School of Law, once wrote, "To me, the term reparations is much broader than monetary payment or merely financial compensation for slave labor." She, like the Black Creeks who want to reclaim their citizenship, subscribes to a broader and more nuanced view of reparations. For them, it is not a static, transactional experience, but a movement to reclaim American history. For Pratt, she wrote, "This form of reparations requires thorough investigation into what actually happened and prods us to ask how and why it happened." This is what the Simmons family has been doing. Their lawsuits have established fact bases that show how their citizenship has been stripped, DeMario and his clients would argue unjustly, and they have prodded the Creek Nation and the U.S. Department of the Interior to answer why it happened. Though we know the answer, being Black in America has become, in the eyes of many, destructive to any other identity they might hold. What this requires is for us to, as Pratt writes, stop retelling the story from the perspective of the people who have traditionally had the voice and tell new stories from the perspective of those who have been subordinated in silence. DeMario's family have had their stories told by those who cast aside their memories of their ancestors as too Black to be fully Creek. What they want from their lawsuits is, as Carla Pratt has written, to restore their humanity and to reclaim a lost perspective for the nation's history. That's the power of their stories, restoring a perspective on America's history that could be all but lost. These stories also have changed me. That 13-year-old version of myself thought of reparations as too far, too radical, and too difficult. At that time, the notion of reparations was fundamentally at odds with what I believed about Black progress. Reparations were tactile and tangible, a repayment for how the country subdued and subjugated Blackness over centuries, while my notions of Black progress were stuck in the theoretical. For example, the idea of setbacks to equality being only temporary, since the universe bent toward justice. I allowed theoretical questions to complicate every imagined challenge to implementing reparations. How could we pay for this? Should I, a son of Jamaican immigrants, benefit from reparations? Would white people ever go for tax dollars from every paycheck going towards paying for sins they don't think they personally committed? These questions caused me to doubt the legitimacy of reparations. I needed new stories to understand how linear and direct and calculable the damage done to Black life in America had been. I needed those stories to understand what was owed, and how the fact that what was owed was not being paid has impacted our sense of justice in America. Or perhaps I needed to see ancient stories, like those of the Black Creek, in new ways. The stories of people who realize that America comes up short in what is owed to Black people, even Black people like me. It wasn't until I traced the transfer of injustice down generations that I understood the moral imperative of reparations, because the stories of Khao Tam and his descendants showed me that there has always been another way to be Black than what America has told us. Chapter 16, American Collateral. In ways so embedded that it is rarely apparent, the set of assumptions, privileges, and benefits that accompany the status of being white have become a valuable asset that whites sought to protect and that those who passed sought to attain. Only white possession and occupation of land was validated, and therefore privileged as a basis for property rights. Cheryl Harris. I've often bristled at the notion that America has always been a great country. In many important senses, America is a great country, but it's particularly great at building a narrative of continued forward progress. Today was better than yesterday, yesterday was better than the day before, and tomorrow will be better than all the days before it. We bet on our future because we believe our future is secured. But our country bets on its success with extreme confidence, in part because we have been great at accepting a certain amount of collateral damage, and Black and Native life in America has often been the acceptable collateral. But in the case of this family, the Simmons family, Black Native life has been the ideal form of collateral. Tomorrow was always going to be better for large segments of our country because time and time again, we collateralized Black life. Black life, and Black Native life in America have been endlessly used as collateral, as the cost of building a nation that takes little of these lives into account. To build the wealth of this country, Black bodies had been used without consent and without compensation. And centuries later, when these descendants ask for their piece of the pie, for reparations, they have been told it is unfair to receive a piece of what they built. To found and to grow this country, Native land was co-opted, Native customs sacrificed to make way for a life that white people, colonizers, government leaders, farmers, businessmen, thought would be better for themselves. We saw it when we learned that Khao Tam was called his Negro Tom by Ethan Allen Hitchcock. In Hitchcock's eyes, his worthiness was tied to the servitude he offered the chief, Yargi. When Benjamin Hawkins collateralized indigenous life and its varied customs in order to boost the economic prosperity of America, he attempted to diminish, intentionally or unintentionally, Native American life. When his acolytes sought to deal with the so-called Indian problem, and when his predecessors and successors tried to deal with the so-called Negro problem, they all tried to minimize them to the parts of their identity that were useful for the advancement of an American identity that didn't include them. Black people's and Native people's identities were relegated to items on rolls. Their holdings on lands diminished, and their stake in the promise of the American dream limited by whatever concessions America thought it least discomforting to its white citizens to give them. Senators Dawes and Bixby reduced what had been set aside as Native land and Black Native land, guaranteeing that white settlers would co-opt land and opportunities that had belonged to their Native and Black counterparts. Then Dawes and Bixby went further by creating identity parameters and racializing Creek identity. They made claims race-based. If you were Black or Black Creek, you became less valuable, less worth fighting for, and someone whose rights became worth trampling over to achieve the vision of America that was just that much less accommodating. And Chief Clark Cox, Estilusti himself, the remnants of Black identity running through his veins, used the rich beauty of Creek and Black Creek identity to make the Creek Nation even more independent from the dictates of the U.S. government. We have done this in America for hundreds of years. We accept minimizing non-white life in America to help us maintain the status quo. The idea of Black lives being pushed further to the margins had become so entrenched in our national character that expelling Black Creeks from the Creek Nation became a worthwhile way to carve a path of independence for the Creek Nation, a path charted and led by a white government. Perhaps by re-including the Black Creek, the very people whose ancestors led the Creek Nation, in the Creek Nation, is how we begin this critical project of valuing the very people who became collateral damage in the messy business of the United States. If the stories of Cowtown, the Black Creeks, and their long struggle teach us anything, it is that our humanity should not be thrown aside to achieve anything. In creating what's best for tomorrow, America should rely on the collective strength of our humanity, not the value that one part of our society can extract from it. Chapter 17, Empowerment, Not Dilution. History, with its hard spine and dog-eared corners, will be replaced with nuance. Tracy Smith, Sci-Fi. Born in New York City and raised there for the first 8 years of my life, I attended a church full of Jamaican, Trinidadian, and Bahamian immigrants, pastored by my Jamaican grandfather. In my home, I had two Jamaican parents, and my church friends, the only friends I was allowed to have in my strict, slightly Pentecostal household, were all the sons and daughters of those same Caribbean immigrants. Thanksgiving dinners, church potlucks, and Easter dinners, which we'd call Resurrection Sunday, because somehow Easter was pagan, came replete with all the quasi-soul food American fixings laid messily next to Caribbean staples. When we moved to Oklahoma, I attended predominantly white schools, where I was asked indelicate questions about my race. In reply, I'd stumble over a complex set of half-truths. Well, I'm Black, but I'm Jamaican, but not directly from Jamaica, from New York, but my parents are Jamaican, but they immigrated decades ago and don't sound that Jamaican unless they're upset at me for not doing the dishes. Eventually, I'd just masquerade and align myself with the larger diaspora, simply answering, I'm Black. But nearly every Black Creek I've met tells me something both authentic and radical. I'm both fully Black and fully Creek. They contained multitudes, and each time they told me, their proclamation compelled me to recognize the multitudes I contain. To not be fully both diminishes an important part of our history that some of our country want to forget. Simplifying the identity of a person to fit in a category is a degradation of critical history, and even more, their claim on who they have been, who they are, and who they can become. If this history were appreciated, it could have a major impact on the Black Creek because it would also be true to how they view themselves. Imagine if Cao Tom's descendants are right. Perhaps Cao Tom being recorded as a slave was just the simplification of identity run amok. Maybe Ethan Allen Hitchcock, the young colonel who chronicled Cao Tom's life, just couldn't wrap his mind around the notion that a black man could be simultaneously free, never enslaved, and fully Creek. And perhaps today we are similarly too wedded to our notions of who people are or who people are not. We let our simplistic misconceptions about race triumph rather than allow identities to be beautifully complex. For decades, members of the Creek Nation and many other Native Americans worried about the purity of their blood, a concern they didn't have until white settlers coveted their land and told them they should care about this distinction. This is why they began anchoring their citizenship by blood. They made their nations, which are legally political entities, into race-simplifying institutions, nations that destroy the opportunity for Black Creeks to be fully Black and fully Creek. To the Creek Nation, these Black Creeks, despite their well-documented claims to being Creek, are imperfections that dilute true Creekness. Cao Tom's descendants, Legis Perryman's descendants, and countless other Black Creeks have rebuffed this for decades, confidently claiming that they are both fully Black and fully Creek. But being fully Black and fully Creek, and embracing all that comes from both identities, can be dangerous to our more simplistic patriotism. It tells America that Blackness and indigeneity are not dilutive on their own or together. Instead, they are empowering. But empowering Black lives represents the undoing of white supremacy. White supremacy, even when it is conveyed as help, has as its main goals the words of Henry Dawes: "The work is accomplished when the Indian has become one of us." And the only way this goal could be accomplished is if people like Dawes, like Hawkins before him, and Washington before him, could wash away the memories that made them. The goal of white supremacy is to frame identities and their value in relation to whiteness. The closer to white, the better. Put another way, if Cao Tom, Jake Simmons Sr., his son, Jake Simmons Jr., Jake Jr.'s grandniece, Johnny Mae, and her grandson, Demario Solomon, take control of the narratives of their own identity history and actively fight to reclaim what's theirs, this disconnects them from needing to define themselves separate from the white perspective that Washington, Hawkins, Dawes, Posey, and countless others have held for their own purposes. These families' existence and their refusal to let go of their identity history are threats to white supremacy in America. Perhaps if I had known their stories earlier, my childhood wouldn't have been marked with stammered responses to questions about my race. I distinctly remember one of my well-meaning white high school teachers bastardizing Black history. It wasn't a class about Black history. We had just finished discussing a few Supreme Court cases, and with pity in his eyes, he looked at me, the lone Black boy in the class, and said, "It's a bad world out there for you." While yes, the world would be harder for me as a Black boy becoming a Black man, my teacher had reduced me and my history to a few highlights: a long period of slavery, some rights afforded to us that we couldn't quite discern. He left me with little to appreciate about my skin tone while extolling white folks who thought they gave me rights. He had bought into the same reductionist view of history and identity and could only manage to shed his tear, look at me, and say, "It's going to be a bad world out there for you." My teacher, white as he was, knew that he had benefited from this simple sorting, white and non-white. He knew that I had been dealt a bad hand, so I became the subject of his pity. Remember, Native Americans, Creeks included, weren't a race until people like Henry Dawes made them into one, counting fictitious quanta of blood, telling Black Creeks that they were too Black to be Creek. As the Creeks bought into the notions of race and racism and anti-indigeneity when Claude Cox orchestrated the changing of the Creek Constitution in 1979, they effectively kicked out most of the Black Creeks, Cao Tom's descendants included. excluding black folks from an independent nation that for generations had embraced them, made the nation just that much whiter. It was a feather in the cap of white supremacy. Blackness became the great simplifier, removing any remnant of the beautiful complexities of being part of the Creek Nation. Today, we limit what opportunity those who are not white can have, what purchase on advancement they can enjoy. We tell kids of color, kids like me, to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps after centuries of fiddling with our access to our American identity. The project of white settlers was to eradicate America's first people, the indigenous, either through war or through civilizing them. Think back to what Dawes wanted to do to and for the indigenous. When that time comes, there can be no reservation to abolish or to perpetuate, no Indian agent to appoint or dismiss, no treaty to keep or abrogate. This, however, was not the project for black people. Use us to build an economy that supports white capitalism. Subjugate, leverage, deploy, and exploit us to generate capital. Define us legally as less than human as you empower white settlers and slavers to number us. Make sure the first law on the books in Oklahoma, the former Indian Territory, is a segregation law, an ode to Jim Crow. Tell the blacks they can't be in the same train cars, bathrooms, schoolhouses, restaurants as the white folks. Tell them that blacks can no longer marry their Creek brothers and sisters, but tell the white folks that they can. And what about the Simmons family? What do you do with people who can boast of an ancestor, a Creek chief named Cow Tom who negotiated deals on behalf of not only the black folks, but all Creeks? Dawes and countless other supposedly helpful white men throughout history had an answer. Make them black. Make them freedmen, even when this family boasts never having had shackles around their ankles, hands, and necks. That's how you dilute your history. You let a someone else, someone white, dilute whatever power that Black Creek history and identity have given them. The Simmons family, like the rest of the Black Creeks, clamoring for their rights, produced tension generated by a hierarchy that neither Black folks nor Creeks ever wanted or requested. White supremacy in America has been trying to tell all Americans that race is biological, trying to convince us that there's nothing wrong that trying to be as white as possible can't fix. White supremacy has been telling Americans that race making is simple. A person is black if any drop of blackness can be found in them, while also telling us to forget that the single drop rule of blackness was just a way of counting more blacks to use as free labor, slave labor. White supremacy has been telling me that I can't be complicated, that my Jamaicanness somehow makes me less black than anyone else, with less ability to claim every aspect of my lived black experience in this country. White supremacy has been telling us through our laws, our curricula, our schools, and our capitalism who we ought to be in order to be as close to the expectations of whiteness as possible. Cow Tom, Cow Tom's descendants, and those fighting in the courts today tell me that ain't what that is. They and I are the expression of the journey to here, the journey to belong, even when America tells me that we don't belong. The identities of those on the margins are messy assemblages of joy and pain, triumph and tragedy, rising and descending hope in what this country could be. So now my original explanation is told with more confidence than before. I am who I am because my ancestors were fully black and fully Jamaican. I am fully American and carry with me every bit of the stories that made me. The stories of the Black Creek inspired my reexamination of who I am and where I come from. And so should such stories help us all. Despite the wishes of some, America can become a big table, with room enough for everyone with their strange, complex, beautiful past, present, and future. But only if we grab hold to the history that without telling in all of its difficult, ugly, yet hopeful ways could continue to divide us. In writing this, I'm asking you not to give up on your vision of America. I'm asking you to make America even more beautiful, to actively paint a bigger picture, a richer one, that encompasses all the things we've been, all the ways we've been, so that we might realize all we can become. This is Caleb Gale. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of We Refuse to Forget, a true story of Black Creek's American identity and power. This program was directed by Carlin Daigle, executive producer Nithya Rajendran, edited by Elephant Audiobooks. Text copyright 2022 by Caleb J. Gale. Production copyright 2022, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.